This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome, curious minds, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging headfirst into a stack of critical sources that lay bare the intricate world of criminal investigations and crime scene management.
It's a fascinating area.
It really is. Okay, let's unpack this. We've got some fascinating documents here laying out the fundamentals, the real nitty-gritty details, and just the sheer precision needed to solve crimes and bring cases to justice. You're basically about to get a shortcut to being truly well-informed on a field that, honestly, most of us only ever see dramatized on TV.
What's really fascinating here, I think, is how these sources emphasize the blend. It's science, mm-hmm. It's legal understanding, and it's also, you know, human judgment that goes into every single investigation.
Mm.
It really is a complete ecosystem, much more complex and methodical than many people might imagine. We're going to explore not just what happens, but really why each step is so crucial.
Yeah, the why is key.
From the very first responder arriving right through to that final case file being closed, every stage matters.
Absolutely. So your mission for this deep dive, if you choose to accept it, is to quickly get up to speed on the essential elements of criminal investigation. We'll cover everything from defining what a crime even is to the really meticulous management of a complex case. Think of this as your backstage pass, you know, understanding the unseen effort behind every solved case and why that effort is so incredibly vital for justice.
Right. And by the end of this deep dive, you really will have a comprehensive grasp of these methodical processes involved. You'll gain insights into the immense precision required in modern law enforcement, understanding how investigators navigate these really complex legal rules while pursuing the truth, and how every detail, no matter how small it seems, really contributes to the bigger picture.
Okay, so let's kick things off. Let's define the core concept. What exactly is a criminal investigation? Our sources tell us it's, quote, the process of legally gathering evidence of a crime that has been or is being committed. Simple enough, but profound. And a crime scene search is defined as a planned and coordinated legal search to locate physical evidence or witnesses. So why is that phrase, legally gathering evidence, why is that so incredibly crucial right from the start? It really sets the stage, doesn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely foundational. That word legally, it's the linchpin for the entire process.
Right.
Every single piece of evidence, every interview they conduct, every search warrant they execute, it must adhere to strict legal frameworks, the rules of evidence, constitutional rights.
So if they mess that up?
If evidence is gathered improperly, say, without the right warrant or through coercion, it can be challenged and potentially thrown out of court. Doesn't matter how damning it seems. It's not just the technicality either. It's what protects our individual rights, ensures due process. You know, imagine a confession beaten out of someone or vital evidence found during an illegal search.
Yeah, that can't stand.
In a fair system, it just can't. And that other part, the planned and coordinated search, that highlights it's not some chaotic free-for-all at the scene.
Right, not like on TV sometimes where everyone's just wandering around.
Exactly. It's a strategic, almost scientific operation designed to maximize finding evidence while minimizing any contamination. Think of it like a surgeon prepping for an operation. Every tool, every movement is deliberate, calculated for the best outcome.
That's a great analogy. It makes perfect sense. So to really understand this legal landscape, we need to dive into some core terms, right? The foundational definitions. How do they all fit together?
Yes, let's lay that groundwork. These are the building blocks. First, a crime. The definition is an act or omission forbidden by law and punishable by a fine, imprisonment, or even death. It's basically what society, through its laws, has decided is unacceptable conduct.
Okay, forbidden and punishable. Simple enough. What's next?
Then we have corpus delicti. It literally translates to the body or substance of the crime.
Okay.
Legally, it means the proof that a crime has actually happened. You have to prove not just that something occurred, but that it occurred because of a criminal act.
So like in a murder case, it's not just finding a body.
Exactly. It's proving the death was caused by a criminal act. Showing the cause of death wasn't natural or accidental, but points to, you know, foul play. That's establishing the corpus delicti for homicide.
Okay. So it's not just someone is dead, but someone was murdered. Got it.
Precisely. And that leads us directly to the elements of a crime. These are the specific conditions, the ingredients, if you will, that must all be present for an act to be classified as a particular crime.
Like a recipe.
Kind of, yeah. For example, take theft. You usually need to prove, one, that property was taken, two, that it belonged to someone else, and three, that there was an intent to permanently deprive the owner of it.
Right. All three need to be there.
Yes. All those specific conditions are the elements. An investigator has to gather proof for each element to establish the corpus delicti of that specific crime.
Okay, so investigators need to prove each of those elements to establish the corpus delicti. What about the actual stuff they find? That's evidence, right?
Yes, exactly. Evidence is anything offered in court to prove the truth or falsity of a fact in contention. It's the information, tangible or intangible, that helps establish the facts of the case.
And a fact.
A fact is simply something known to be true. Seems obvious, but it's a key distinction in legal terms.
Right.
Now, when we talk about how a crime was committed, we often hear about the modus operandi, or MO.
The MO, yeah. Heard that one a lot.
It's a criminal's characteristic method of operation. Their signature style, you could say.
Mm.
Maybe a burglar always cuts the phone lines first, or a con artist always uses the same sob story.
I can see how that would be super useful, linking crimes together.
Incredibly useful. It helps connect potentially separate incidents to the same person or group.
Okay. Now, are there different kinds of evidence we should be aware of? I remember hearing about circumstantial evidence.
Yes, that's a crucial distinction. Circumstantial evidence is indirect evidence. It doesn't directly prove the fact in question, like an eyewitness seeing the crime happen. Instead, it's evidence from which logical deductions can be drawn.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Finding a suspect's unique muddy boot print right outside a broken window at a burglary scene. That's circumstantial evidence. It doesn't show them breaking the window.
But it puts them there right around the time it happened.
Exactly. It implies their presence and involvement. This differs from direct evidence, like, say, security footage capturing the act itself.
But circumstantial evidence can still be really powerful, can it?
Oh, absolutely. Especially when you start piecing multiple bits of it together. Each piece might be small, but combined, they can create a very strong, compelling picture. Like weaving a rope from many thin threads. It's often the bulk of evidence in many cases.
So proving corpus delicti means using both direct and circumstantial evidence to establish all those elements of the crime.
Correct. Building that complete logical picture for the court.
Okay, that distinction is really important. Now, when all this evidence is collected, it faces a really high hurdle in court. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Our sources describe this as the level of certainty a juror needs for conviction. It's a real doubt based upon reason and common sense after careful and impartial consideration. And importantly, not a mere possible doubt.
Mm-hmm. The highest standard.
So what does that phrase moral certainty really mean for a juror in practice? And how does an investigator actively try to collect corroborating evidence specifically to negate potential defense claims? That sounds like playing chess.
It is like playing chess in a way, anticipating moves. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest legal standard we have. Moral certainty doesn't mean absolute, 100% certainty, like mathematical proof. That's often impossible in real life.
Right.
It means that after weighing all the evidence, fairly and impartially, the jurors have an abiding conviction of the truth of the charge. There's no reasonable explanation for the facts other than the defendant's guilt. It's a deep, reasoned belief, not just a hunch or suspicion.
Okay. A reasoned, abiding conviction. Not just any doubt, but a reasonable one.
Exactly. Think about getting on an airplane. You don't have absolute 100% proof it won't crash. But based on safety records, inspections, the crew's demeanor, You achieve a moral certainty that it's safe enough to board. It's that kind of practical certainty.
Okay, that helps. So how do investigators anticipate and negate defenses?
That's where thorough, proactive investigation comes in. They need to think about likely defenses for that type of crime. If it's a burglary and the suspect might claim an alibi, the investigator needs to actively seek evidence refuting that alibi.
Like cell phone records placing them near the scene.
Precisely. Cell tower pings, GPS data from their car if available, maybe surveillance footage from a nearby store showing them not where they claim to be, or testimony from independent witnesses contradicting the alibi. Or, say the defense might be accident. In an assault case, maybe the suspect claims they swung wildly and didn't mean to hit the victim so hard. The investigator needs forensic evidence, like specific wound patterns, indicating a deliberate forceful blow, or maybe evidence of prior threats that contradicts the accident claim.
So they're building their case and dismantling the defense's potential case simultaneously?
That's the goal of a really thorough investigation. It's not just collecting incriminating evidence, but also evidence that closes off avenues for reasonable doubt.
Wow, that's foresight. Now, before we even get near beyond reasonable doubt, there are other legal thresholds investigators work with, right? Like probable cause.
Yes, absolutely.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
There's a crucial sliding scale of certainty that dictates what actions law enforcement can legally take. Huh? Below proof, beyond a reasonable doubt for conviction, you have probable cause.
Okay, what's that?
The definition is basically having enough credible information, facts, and circumstances that would lead a reasonable and prudent person to believe two things are possible. Either, one, that a particular suspect committed or is committing a specific crime, which justifies an arrest, or two, that there's a fair probability that evidence of a crime or contraband will be found in a particular place, which justifies asking a judge for a search warrant.
So more than a hunch needs solid info.
Definitely. It's a substantial standard, requires concrete, believable facts. It's the gatekeeper for major intrusions like arrests and searches.
And there's something even below that.
Yes, there's reasonable suspicion. This is a lower threshold. It's defined as having specific, articulable facts together with rational inferences from those facts that would reasonably warrant the detention of a person.
Articulable facts, meaning things you can actually point to.
Exactly. Not just a vague feeling or a guess. It allows an officer to briefly stop and question someone, a temporary detention, often called a Terry stop, if they can point to specific, observable things that suggest criminal activity might be happening or about to happen.
Like your example earlier. Ski mask, bank, July, duffel bag.
Perfect example. That gives you reasonable suspicion to stop and ask questions. It's enough for a brief detention and inquiry, but not enough for an arrest on its own. It's more than a hunch, but less than probable cause.
Okay, so it's a clear gradient. Reasonable suspicion lets you stop and ask questions briefly. Probable cause lets you arrest or get a search warrant. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is needed for a conviction in court.
That's the scale.
Why is having this gradient so important? It seems like it balances things out.
It's absolutely critical for balancing state power with individual liberty. Think about it. If police needed probable cause for every interaction, even just asking a question, they'd be incredibly hampered in preventing crime or doing basic investigation.
Right, they couldn't intervene early.
But on the flip side, if near reasonable suspicion was enough to arrest someone or search their home, our freedoms would be seriously eroded. This graduated system allows for increasingly intrusive actions only as the level of certainty rises.
Makes sense.
It safeguards our rights while still enabling law enforcement to do its job effectively. And it also ties into the legal significance of evidence, how much weight evidence carries at each stage. It ensures the response matches the level of justified suspicion.
It's all about that precision, again, even in the level of certainty required. Okay, let's shift to the practical side. What are investigators' main goals, their primary objectives, and what tools do they actually use?
Well, the ultimate overarching goal is always to determine the truth about what happened. How did this crime occur? Who was involved? But drilling down, there are several key objectives. First, determine if a crime was actually committed in the first place. Then, legally obtain information and evidence to identify the person or persons responsible. Third, legally arrest the suspect. Fourth, recover any stolen property, the fruits of the crime. And finally, present the best possible case to the prosecutor for charging.
And you mentioned earlier, sometimes the goal is also to disprove involvement.
Absolutely crucial. A good investigator follows the facts wherever they lead. That includes gathering information that might clear someone. The job isn't just to build a case against a pre-chosen suspect, it's to find out what really happened. And importantly, they have to recognize that not all crimes can be solved despite best efforts.
That's a sobering but important reality check. So what does best case possible really mean? Is it just dumping a pile of evidence on the prosecutor's desk?
No. Definitely not just quantity. Best case possible is about the quality, the admissibility, and the coherence of the evidence. It means having legally obtained, meticulously documented, compelling information that clearly establishes every element of the crime and links the suspect to it.
Okay.
It also means, as we discussed, anticipating and proactively negating those likely defense arguments. It's about building a clear, logical narrative supported by strong, verifiable facts, presented in a way that minimizes ambiguity and can withstand legal challenges.
So it's a solid, well-told story backed by proof.
Exactly. A story so compelling and well-supported that a prosecutor looks at it and feels confident they can meet that high, beyond a reasonable doubt, standard in court.
Fascinating. Okay, so what are the actual tools in their toolkit? And maybe more importantly, what are the personal characteristics that make someone a really good investigator? Because you hinted earlier, it's not just technical skill, it's the human element too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The human element is arguably just as important, if not more so sometimes.
Yeah.
Let's talk tools first. They fall into a few broad categories. One is information. This comes from people, victims, witnesses, informants, even suspects, and also from records, databases, reports, open sources now too. Ooh. Information is king.
Mm-hmm.
Two is instrumentation or forensic science. This is the science-y stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Fingerprints, DNA, serology, studying bodily fluids like blood, semen ballistics, which is the science of firearms and bullets, tool mark analysis, digital forensics, all that technical analysis.
The CSI stuff.
Right. Three is interviewing and interrogation. Distinct skills, really. Interviewing gathers information. Interrogation tries to get admissions or confessions from suspects believed to be guilty. Both require immense skill.
Yeah, I bet.
And the fourth tool, maybe the most critical in some ways, is a deep understanding and application of the laws of arrest, search, and seizure. Knowing the rules of the game, what you can do, when, and how is paramount. But again, even the best evidence is useless if collected illegally.
Okay, so information, forensics, interviewing, and law. Those are the main tools. What about the personal traits? What makes a great investigator?
This is where it gets really interesting. You need a certain mindset, certain characteristics. They need to be suspicious, but in a professional way. Not cynical, but taking nothing at face value. Always verifying, always checking credibility. People misremember, people lie, people have agendas. You have to question.
Constantly asking why and how do you know that?
Exactly. They need to be intensely curious. A genuine desire to uncover the facts, to understand the why behind things. Noticing small inconsistencies, things that don't quite add up. Digging deeper.
Observant too, I imagine.
Highly observant, using all five senses. Taking accurate notice, keeping things in view, paying attention to details others might miss, the environment, people's reactions, small physical clues.
And you mentioned objectivity before. How crucial is that?
Absolutely critical. An investigator must be unbiased and unprejudiced. Personal feelings, biases about certain types of people or crimes, preconceived notions, they have to be actively suppressed. Letting bias creep in leads to sloppy work, wrong conclusions, and ultimately profound unfairness.
That sounds incredibly difficult in high-stress situations.
It is a constant discipline, especially with disturbing crimes or difficult suspects. They also need to be skilled at developing rapport. This means excellent interpersonal communication, being patient, courteous, empathetic, even when dealing with difficult or hostile people.
Building trust.
Yes, it's a strategic skill. People talk more openly when they feel heard and respected. It's not just about being nice. It's about effective information gathering.
What else? Logical thinking.
Definitely. Logical thinking is key. Applying logic to compare behavior to statements, assessing motivations, connecting disparate pieces of information, spotting inconsistencies between the physical evidence and someone's story. Thinking critically, like a chess player analyzing the board.
And
finally, creative problem solving. Thinking outside the box, but always within the legal and ethical boundaries. Finding innovative ways to get information or evidence when standard methods fail. Adapting to unique situations without compromising the rules. It's that blend of discipline and adaptability.
Wow. Suspicious, curious, observant, unbiased, rapport builder, logical, creative. It's quite a demanding profile.
It truly is. It takes a unique combination of skills and personality traits.
Okay, with that strong foundation laid, let's move into the very first moments after a crime is reported. The preliminary investigation. Imagine you're that first officer arriving on a potentially chaotic scene. It's not just random action. Our sources show a very structured, almost choreographed response in those critical early stages. It's broken down into 5 key stages. It kicks off with 1, scene security and protection, then 2, first responder investigation, 3, processing the crime scene, 4, scene wrap-up, and finally 5, conclude and document. And the absolute first priority, always, safety, persons, then evidence. Why is this so vital to document changes made during rescue efforts and to start that chain of custody immediately?
Those initial moments are incredibly fluid and often chaotic, so having these stages provides a critical framework. Mm. That persons then evidence priority is non-negotiable. Saving lives, rendering aid, that always comes first.
Right.
But during those life-saving efforts, the scene will inevitably be disturbed. Maybe paramedics move furniture to reach a victim or officers force open a door. Documenting every single change made during rescue is vital. Because later on, those alterations could be misinterpreted as part of the crime itself if they aren't recorded. A moved chair, a cut piece of clothing. Documenting why it was changed prevents confusion or, worse, incorrect theories about the crime later.
Ah, okay. Preserves the original context as much as possible.
Exactly. And starting the chain of custody immediately, from the very second, evidence is recognized. That's about legal integrity.
We talked about that earlier, the evidence biography.
Right. It's the foundation for that evidence being admissible in court. If there's a break in the chain, an unexplained gap where someone could have tampered with it, the defense will absolutely challenge it and it might get excluded. Doesn't matter how important it is. Starting it right away, marking and tracking from discovery is non-negotiable.
Got it. Integrity from second one. So what are those crucial initial actions an officer takes right upon arrival? It must be a whirlwind assessment.
It is. It's an immediate, high-stakes, dynamic assessment.
Mm.
First, determine if suspects are still present or nearby. Look for unusual activity, people fleeing, suspicious vehicles idling.
Okay, threat assessment first.
Always. Take appropriate tactical action if the offense is actually in progress. Note any weapons involved. Check the number of suspects crucial for officer safety and deciding if backup is needed.
Right.
Then, immediately, first aid or request EMS for any injuries. Life safety is paramount. After that immediate safety check, quickly search the perimeter of the building or area for obvious entry or exit points, open doors, broken windows, and locate the key people, the victims, any witnesses, the person who called it in, the complainant or reporter. The absolute rule is, make the scene safe and secure before starting the detailed investigation. You can't process evidence effectively if you're still dealing with immediate threats.
Makes total sense. Secure first, then investigate. Yeah. And once that initial assessment is done, what critical info needs to be shared fast among officers? You said speed is key.
Absolutely. Speeding communication can be the difference between catching a suspect nearby or them getting away clean. Officers need to rapidly identify and broadcast any known information about the suspect, description, clothing, direction they fled.
Vehicle description, too.
Yes, involve vehicles, any weapons seen, direction of travel, and also any fruits of the crime that might have been taken, specific stolen items, cash description, etc. Getting this info out quickly over the radio allows for a coordinated response, setting up roadblocks, searching the area effectively. It mobilizes everyone fast.
Like an instant alert system. Okay, threats assessed, info shared. How do they legally secure the scene itself? What are these inner and outer perimeters, and what gives them the legal right to block people off?
Securing the scene is about preserving evidence integrity. It involves establishing clearly defined entry and exit points, usually just one of each, if possible, to minimize anyone tracking dirt in or evidence out, or just general contamination.
It's a log point.
Exactly. Everyone entering or leaving is logged. Then they set up perimeters, typically using barrier tape, vehicles, or personnel. The inner perimeter is the most critical zone. It encompasses the immediate area where the core crime occurred and where the most sensitive evidence is likely concentrated around a body, the point of entry, where a struggle happened. Access here is strictly limited.
Got it. The hot zone.
Right. The outer perimeter creates a larger buffer zone around the inner one. It controls access for essential personnel only, detectives, techs, ME, keeps media and onlookers well back, and might also contain secondary evidence, like discarded items, tire tracks, or escape routes. It protects the inner scene from contamination and manages the overall chaos.
Okay, inner core, outer buffer. What gives them the legal authority to tell people you can't come in here?
They have specific legal authority, primarily from state statutes or codes. Our sources mentioned the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, for example. CCP Chapter 6.06 gives a peace officer authority to prevent injury. Chapter 6.07 covers their general conduct and duties. For death scene specifically, Chapter 49 deals with inquests. Section 49.25 outlines the medical examiner's duties, 49.05 covers removing bodies and property, and 49.22 actually allows the ME to seal the premises where a death occurred. These laws provide the legal backbone for controlling access and protecting the scene.
And if someone ignores that tape and walks in...
That raises a really important question. Unauthorized entry can have serious consequences. Legally, the person could face charges like obstruction or interfering with an investigation, but for the case itself, the bigger problem is evidence contamination. If someone unauthorized enters, especially the inner perimeter, they can destroy fragile evidence, leave their own DNA or fingerprints, or alter the scene in ways that confuse the investigation. It casts doubt on the integrity of any evidence found after the breach. A defense attorney would have a field day questioning if evidence was planted or contaminated because the scene wasn't secure. It can be devastating.
Huge implications.
Yeah.
Really highlights why those perimeters aren't just suggestions.
Okay, beyond the initial patrol officers and maybe detectives, what other special units might get called to a complex scene? And why on earth would the military potentially get involved? That seems extreme.
Yeah, the list of potential specialists really shows how complex investigations can get, requiring collaboration. Obvious ones are EMS for medical care and the medical examiner, or justice of the peace in some areas, for pronounced deaths to determine cause and manner.
Standard for serious scenes.
Right. But then you might need a bomb squad if there's any hint of explosives. The fire department isn't just for fires. They handle hazardous materials, hazmat. Might assess structural safety after an explosion or collapse, or even provide specialized equipment like ladders for high-angle searches or lighting for night scenes.
Okay, makes sense.
The military involvement is very rare and specific. It typically happens only if the crime involves military personnel, occurs on military property, deals with stolen military ordnance, or has major national security implications where specialized federal assets are needed. Maybe military EOD, explosive ordnance disposal, for a unique type of device. It's not for your average burglary, that's for sure. It requires specific jurisdiction or request for assistance.
So, very specific circumstances for military. What other specialists?
You could have narcotics investigators, if drugs are involved, maybe from a specialized task force. Other law enforcement agencies might assist if it's a multi-jurisdictional crime or requires extensive resources. And crucially, you'll have specialized technicians. The crime scene investigators, CSIs, or forensic techs who do the detailed processing, plus supervisors overseeing the operation and the lead detectives taking charge of the overall investigation.
How does an investigator know when to call these different specialists?
It's based on continuous assessment of the scene's evolving needs. If they find unknown powders or liquids, they know to call hazmat or the lab. If a body is found outdoors and decomposing, they might realize an entomologist, an insect expert, could help pinpoint time of death more accurately than standard methods. Or if skeletal remains are found, a forensic anthropologist is needed. If it's a workplace death, OSHA might need to be notified. It's about recognizing the limits of their own expertise and bringing in the right specialist for the specific evidence or situation encountered, matching the expertise to the problem.
Okay, scene secured. Specialist called in or on standby. Now we get into the real heart of it. Processing the crime scene. Our sources list the objectives. Establish a crime occurred, maybe place a suspect there, eliminate people, potentially trigger confessions, support witness accounts, and answer those crucial W questions: where, how, why, when, and the criminal's MO. But conducting such a meticulous search must come with practical problems and hazards, right? What do investigators face?
Absolutely. Those objectives show it's a strategic hunt for information, not just random searching. But the reality of doing it is full of challenges.
First, they have to evaluate the physical characteristics of the scene itself. How big is it? Is it indoors or outdoors? What's the terrain, like woods, apartment, warehouse? How cluttered is it?
Right. A field is different from a tiny bathroom.
Totally different. This assessment dictates the personnel needed may be just two people for a small indoor scene, but a large coordinated team for a sprawling outdoor area. It dictates the equipment needed too. Lights, specialized recovery tools, maybe even mapping tech.
What about thoroughness? Do they always search with the same intensity?
No, the degree of thoroughness depends on the situation.
Yeah.
What type of crime is it? What specific evidence are they hoping to find? What's the purpose of this search? Searching for microscopic fibers or DNA requires an incredibly slow, painstaking, almost inch-by-inch approach. Searching for a missing person in a park might be faster. Covering more ground, looking for larger clues first. It's adaptable.
Okay. And the hazards. You mentioned safety before.
Yes. Safety hazards are a constant concern. Things like down electrical lines, deep water, unstable structures, dense brush hiding trip hazards, or even dangerous wildlife, steep slopes. Investigators have to identify these risks before diving in.
And use protective gear?
Definitely. They assess the need for personal protective equipment, PPE. That means gloves, always, but might also include protective suits, shoe covers to avoid tracking contaminants, face shields or masks if there's airborne debris or biohazards, hair covers, even respirators for chemical fumes or decomposition odors. Using PPE protects the investigator, but just as importantly, it prevents them from contaminating the scene with their own DNA, hair, or fibers. It's a two-way street. All these factors, logistics, safety, environment, impact how feasible and safe it is to recover evidence, requires careful planning.
Sounds like a very dynamic and potentially dangerous workplace. So with all these variables, how do investigators pick the right method for searching? The sources list several: point-to-point, strip grid, circular spiral, quadrant zone, area, aerial, even canines. Can you break down what each is best for?
Sure. Choosing the right search pattern is crucial for efficiency and thoroughness. It really depends, like you said, on the size and type of area and the degree of thoroughness required. It's about picking the right tool for the job. The point-to-point search might be used as an initial walkthrough. You move from the first obvious piece of evidence to the next, then the next. It can help get a feel for the scene.
But it sounds a bit haphazard.
It can be. The source notes, it's often disorganized, might easily overlook trace evidence between the main points, and can encourage premature entry by other personnel. So maybe okay for a quick preliminary look, but not usually for the main detailed search.
Okay, not the go-to for thoroughness. What about the strip search?
The strip line search is highly effective, especially for large outdoor areas like fields or parks. Imagine dividing the area into parallel lanes or strips using ropes, flags, or just natural landmarks. Searchers walk down their assigned lane, looking carefully.
Like mowing a lawn.
Exactly. And the grid search is even more thorough. It's basically doing a strip search twice, once going, say, north-south, and then again covering the same area going east-west.
Ah, a double pass.
Right. It provides two different viewpoints of the same ground, significantly increasing the chance of finding small or subtle evidence. Excellent for maximum coverage outdoors.
Okay, I can picture that. Very methodical. What about indoors or more confined spaces, like a room or a car?
For those, other methods might be better. The circular or spiral concentric search can work well, especially if you think something might be missing from the center of an area or if the entry-exit point is key. Searchers start either at the center and spiral outwards, or start at the edges and spiral inwards.
Like ripples in a pond, almost?
Kind of, yeah. Then there's the quadrant, sector, or zone search. This is really effective for areas with clear boundaries or sections, both indoors and outdoors. You divide the scene into manageable zones or quadrants, like dividing a house into rooms, or a car into front seat, back seat, trunk. Then you can search each zone systematically. Maybe even using different types of searches within different zones, depending on what you expect to find there. Very organized, good for complex indoor scenes or vehicles.
Allows you to tailor the search within the zone, makes sense. Any other specialized methods?
Yes. There's the area search, which is just using whatever method works best for a specific, small, well-defined area, like searching just a single bush where something might have been tossed or a specific pathway. The aerial search uses aircraft, maybe drones now too, potentially with things like infrared imaging. This can be useful for large areas, looking for ground disturbances that might indicate a gravesite, or finding heat signatures.
High-tech overview.
And finally, canines, police dogs. Invaluable for tracking scents, finding suspects who recently fled, or locating missing persons, sometimes even detecting specific substances like drugs or explosives.
But you mentioned timing is crucial for canines.
Extremely. You need to consider using the dog early, before the scene gets heavily contaminated with scents from officers, paramedics, and everyone else walking around. Too much contamination can overwhelm the dog's ability to pick up the specific track they need.
Right, preserve that scent trail. Okay, method chosen. How do they actually implement the search? What are the procedures to make sure it runs smoothly and effectively?
Implementation requires good planning and coordination. First, determine the starting point, usually the most critical area, unless fragile evidence outside needs immediate attention. Establish a command post or headquarters area for communication and coordination. Then, a crucial step, the briefing of the searchers. Everyone involved needs to be on the same page. They cover the known facts of the offense, what type of evidence they're specifically looking for, the chosen search pattern, and critically, the speed of the search.
Speed matters that much.
Oh, yeah. Searching for tiny hairs or fibers requires moving incredibly slowly, maybe even on hands and knees. Searching a large field for a discarded weapon might be faster. The briefing clarifies the pace needed. It also assigns specific areas or lanes of responsibility and reviews the guidelines for properly handling and documenting any evidence found.
Okay, clear roles and goals.
Right. Maintaining constant communication during the search is vital to ensure all areas are covered and there's no unnecessary duplication. And one really good technique for ensuring thoroughness, especially with trace evidence, is alternating searchers. Have one team search an area, then have a different team research the same area. Fresh eyes often spot things the first team missed.
That's clever, a built-in double check.
Exactly. It maximizes the chances of finding everything.
So meticulous planning, clear briefing, careful execution, even double checking. Only then do they really start the detailed documentation, like photography. Which brings us to that critical component, photography. Why is a visual record so much more powerful than just written notes? And what kind of gear did they need?
Photography is absolutely fundamental. It's often called an integral facet of the investigation. Why? Because it creates a permanent, objective, visual record of the scene exactly as it was found, before anything is moved or altered.
Captures the before state.
Precisely. Written notes, no matter how detailed, just can't capture the spatial relationships, the textures, the specific appearance of evidence in context, the lighting. A photo does that instantly. It's a static snapshot in time that can be reviewed over and over by investigators, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and crucially the jury, sometimes years later.
Allows people to see the scene.
Exactly. As for equipment, the sources emphasize using a good quality DSLR camera. Digital single lens reflex, mainly for its high resolution and the ability to use interchangeable lenses.
Different lenses for different jobs.
Yes. You'll typically see a macro lens, which is essential for taking examination quality close-ups, very small details, tool marks on a door frame, fibers on clothing, insect larvae on a body. Then a zoom lens offers flexibility for framing shots at typical crime scene distances, capturing mid-range views. And a telephoto lens can bring distant objects closer, useful for documenting things like escape routes or surveillance points from far away.
What about stability and lighting?
Also crucial. A sturdy tripod is essential. It ensures the camera is stable, preventing blurry photos, especially in low light, where longer exposures are needed. It also helps maintain consistent angles and perspectives for measurement photos. And an external flash unit provides controlled, supplemental light, which is often necessary indoors or at night to ensure evidence is properly illuminated and captured accurately, avoiding harsh shadows or underexposure.
Okay, so the right camera, lenses, tripod, flash. Got it. What are the key rules or procedures for taking crime scene photos to make sure they're accurate and admissible later? You mentioned integrity. What if a photo is blurry or just bad? Do they delete it?
That's a huge point about integrity. First rule. Photos must be taken before anything is disturbed. Capture the scene in its original state. Second, take lots of photos. When in doubt, photograph it. You could always have too few, rarely too many. Third, use measurement scales, like rulers, in close-ups to show size. But, and this is important, always photograph the item first without the scale and then again with a scale in place.
Why both?
So you have a pristine image showing the evidence exactly as found before anything foreign, the scale, was introduced into the frame. It prevents any claim that the scale obscured something.
Smart. Okay.
Procedures. Preparation involves getting camera settings right, checking the flash. The very first photo taken on the memory card is usually an ID card or placard showing the case number, date, location, and photographer's name. Creates an immediate embedded record. A meticulous photo log must be kept, documenting every single shot taken, photo number, description, location, time.
And the blurry photos? Deleting?
Absolutely, do not delete any photos, even if they're out of focus, poorly exposed, or duplicates. Each photo gets a unique number sequentially. Deleting photos creates gaps in that sequence and immediately raises red flags in court. Defense attorneys will jump on that, suggesting evidence was hidden or the record was manipulated. It's far better to have a bad photo logged than a missing photo number. It maintains the integrity of the entire photographic record.
Wow. Okay. Never delete. That's a hard rule. How do they structure the photos? Is there a system?
Yes, there's a methodical progression. Typically, you photograph from the outside in. Start with overall shots of the exterior, showing the building or area and its surroundings, maybe including landmarks. Then move closer, documenting entry exit points. Then move inside, photographing room by room, again starting with overall views and progressively moving closer to specific items of evidence. It's a logical flow, from general context to specific detail.
Like telling a story visually.
Exactly. And to do that effectively, they use three main vantage points or ranges. Overall long range, mid-range, and close-up.
Okay, break those down.
Overall or long range photos give the big picture. They establish the location, think aerial shots, wide views of the street showing the house, or an entire room from corner to corner. They orient the viewer. Mid-range photos bridge the gap. Taken from maybe 10, 20 feet away, they show significant items or evidence in relation to their immediate surroundings within the scene. Like showing a weapon on the floor next to a specific sofa, linking the overall room view to the specific evidence. And close-up photos get right in there. Taken 5 feet or less, often much closer with a macro lens. They capture the critical details of individual pieces of evidence that wouldn't be visible in the wider shots, the serial number on a gun, the pattern on a shoe print, the details of a wound.
So overall context, evidence in context, and evidence detail, like zooming in.
Precisely. These three ranges work together to create that comprehensive visual narrative, allowing someone who wasn't there, like a juror, to understand the scene thoroughly.
That makes perfect sense. What about specific categories of photos they might take? Are they trying to document different aspects of the crime?
Yes, the photos often fall into categories based on what they're intended to show. You'll have photos focusing on the location of the crime itself, the building, the room, the specific spot. Photos showing the nature of the crime, signs of forced entry, ransacking, indications of a struggle.
Okay.
Photos documenting the results of the crime, which can help show the sequence of events. For example, documenting a trail of blood leading from one room to another might illustrate how the incident unfolded. Photos specifically featuring the physical evidence are crucial, clearly showing each item before it's collected. And then there are photos of follow-up activity that might happen away from the primary scene, like autopsy photos, or photos documenting injuries on a living victim, or even a suspect.
How do they photograph injuries specifically?
There's a standard protocol for injuries, too, to ensure clarity and context. First, an overall photo of the person, front and back, showing the injury location generally. Then, a mid-range photo that includes the injury and a nearby anatomical landmark like a joint, elbow, knee. This helps orient the viewer, is it the left arm or right leg? Then finally, close-up shots of the injury itself, using a scale for size reference.
Very systematic. What about credibility? How do they ensure the photos are seen as unbiased and accurate in court? What happens if they're not?
That's the final hurdle, admissibility. The photos must meet certain standards. They need to be accurate representations of what was there. They must be free of distortion, meaning the lens choice or angle doesn't significantly misrepresent distances or shapes. They must be material and relevant to the case, not just random pictures. And critically, they must be unbiased.
How can a photo be biased?
By omission or manipulation. For example, only photographing evidence that supports the prosecution's theory while ignoring potentially exculpatory evidence. Or using lighting and angles to make something look more sinister than it was. Unbiased photography means documenting the scene comprehensively and fairly, showing the good, the bad, and the neutral. It's about presenting the visual truth, not a curated version.
And if it's deemed biased or distorted?
It can be ruled inadmissible. The judge might decide it's unduly prejudicial or misleading to the jury. This can weaken the prosecution's case significantly, and it casts doubt on the investigator's objectivity and the overall integrity of the investigation. Presenting fair and accurate photos is paramount for credibility.
A huge responsibility. Okay, so photography captures what was there in detail. Let's move to sketching. You said earlier sketches help understand where things were, especially relative to each other. Adding precision photos might miss. What's the unique value here?
Exactly. Sketches complement photos beautifully. Their unique value lies in providing a permanent record of conditions not easily captured by photos alone, particularly precise distances and spatial relationships between objects. Photos can sometimes distort perspective or depth.
Right. Wide-angle lenses can make rooms look bigger.
Precisely. Sketches allow you to accurately reconstruct the crime scene layout. They record the exact location of evidence in relation to fixed points in the room or area. They're great for refreshing an investigator's memory months or years later during testimony. They can corroborate witness statements about where things happened. They also allow you to eliminate confusing details. A sketch can focus just on the relevant items and layout, unlike a photo which captures everything, including clutter. And importantly, sketches can be easily enlarged and used as courtroom exhibits, giving the jury a clear, simplified overhead or perspective view of the scene layout.
So photos give the detail, sketches give the precise map and relationships. Adds a whole other layer.
It really does. It adds that measurable geometric precision.
Okay, so how do they create these precise sketches? The sources mention different measurement methods: triangulation, rectangular coordinates, and transecting baseline. Can you explain those? Why different methods?
These are the standard surveying techniques adapted for crime scenes, each suited for different environments. Triangulation is great for precisely locating items when you have at least two fixed, identifiable permanent objects in the scene to measure from, like, two specific corners of a room or a doorway in a window frame.
How does it work?
From each of those two fixed points, you measure the distance directly to the piece of evidence. On your sketch paper, you draw arcs representing those distances to scale. Where the two arcs intersect, that's the exact location of the evidence. It's like using GPS satellites, multiple signals, pinpoint a location. Very accurate, especially for items not near a wall.
Okay, 2 points to pinpoint a third. Makes sense. What about rectangular coordinates?
This method works best in rooms or areas with clear straight lines, like walls. You measure an object's distance from two mutually perpendicular lines. Usually, this means measuring the distance from the object straight to one wall, say the north wall, and then the distance straight to an adjacent wall, say the west wall.
Like coordinates on graph paper.
Right, exactly like graph paper. It gives you precise X and Y coordinates for every piece of evidence relative to the room's boundaries. Very common and effective for indoor scenes.
Okay. And the third one, transecting baseline. Sounds different.
It is. This method is particularly useful for large outdoor scenes, especially irregularly shaped ones, or disaster sites like plane crashes, where you might not have convenient fixed walls or objects to measure from.
So like that big field we talked about?
Perfect example. You lay down a long measuring tape across the scene, establishing a straight baseline from point A to point B. Then, for each piece of evidence, you measure its perpendicular distance from that baseline tape. You also record how far along the baseline tape that perpendicular measurement was taken. It allows you to map out scattered evidence over a large open area relative to that single reference line.
Very adaptable for big, messy scenes. How does doing this accurate sketching help an officer's credibility in court?
Immensely. It demonstrates thoroughness, meticulousness, and professionalism. When an officer presents a clear, accurate, to scale sketch showing precisely where everything was found, it strongly backs up their testimony and observations.
Shows they really documented it carefully.
Right. It shows they didn't just glance around. They took precise measurements and created a formal record. The process itself involves making a rough sketch at the scene. This one needs to be accurate in terms of measurements and object placement, but it doesn't have to be perfectly neat or to scale. It must include an arrow indicating north and clear measurement lines showing what was measured from where. Later, a finished sketch is prepared, usually back at the office. This one is drawn to scale, looks neat and professional, uses a legend or key to identify items with numbers or letters to avoid cluttering the drawing with text, and includes all the case information. Investigator's name or rank, date, time, case number, address, the scale used, or not to scale if appropriate, but measurements must be on the rough sketch. Dimensions of the area and locations of key evidence plotted accurately. The rough sketch with the raw measurements is kept as part of the case file. This whole rigorous process significantly bolsters the officer's credibility and helps the jury visualize the scene accurately.
That level of detail is just incredible. It builds such a strong foundation. And speaking of foundations, let's talk about the chain of custody. We touched on it earlier, but it deserves its own focus. It seems absolutely paramount, doesn't it? Beyond just collecting the evidence, this chain ensures it actually matters in court. Why is it so profoundly important?
You really can't overstate its importance. It's one of those procedural elements that, if done wrong, can completely undermine even the most scientifically compelling evidence. The chain of custody is, essentially, the documented life history of a piece of evidence.
It's biography, you called it.
Exactly. It's the process that meticulously records every single transaction involving that piece of evidence from the moment law enforcement acquires it until it's finally disposed of, often after trial and appeals. It accounts for exactly what happened to the evidence, who had it, and when.
So what specifically does it track?
It needs to clearly document who found the item. Where exactly was it found? Who took custody of it first? How did they mark or identify it? Who transported it from the scene? Where was it stored? When did it go to the crime lab? Who transported it there? Who received it at the lab? When was it returned? Who received it back? Every single transfer, every single handler, it needs to be an unbroken, verifiable chain.
Wow, that sounds like an incredibly rigorous audit trail. What are the actual procedures for establishing and maintaining this chain? And what happens if that chain is broken? What are the real consequences?
The procedures are designed to ensure that integrity. First, you have to preserve the evidence itself, prevent alteration or contamination. Then, you mark the evidence directly, if possible, or the container it's placed in. The mark should include the collector's initials or identifier, the date, the case number, and often the item number.
Okay, marking is key.
Yes. If the item is too small to mark, or marking would damage it like a tiny fiber, it goes into a sealed container like an envelope or bag, and that container is marked and sealed with evidence tape, often initialed across the seal. Then, the guidelines for maintaining the chain. Limit the number of people who handle the evidence as much as possible. Fewer hands mean fewer chances for error or tampering. Every time the evidence changes hands, it must be documented who it went to, the date and time, and the reason for the transfer. The person receiving it should sign for it, creating a receipt. Anyone handling the package should ideally add their own initials and date to the packaging itself. And when evidence comes back, say from the lab, the investigator must check their original mark to confirm it's the same item they submitted.
A lot of checks and balances.
Yeah.
So the big question, what if there's a gap? Someone forgets to log a transfer or a signature is missing?
That's where it gets dangerous for the prosecution. A broken chain of custody creates doubt. The defense attorney will argue, quite reasonably, we don't know what happened to this evidence during that undocumented period. It could have been tampered with, switched, contaminated.
And the consequence?
The most significant consequence is that the judge might rule the evidence inadmissible. It can't be presented to the jury. If that evidence was crucial, say, the DNA linking the suspect, or the murder weapon, its exclusion, could cripple the prosecution's case, potentially leading to charges being dropped or an acquittal, regardless of how strong the evidence might otherwise seem. It underscores why this seemingly bureaucratic process is absolutely fundamental to the legal process.
That really drives home why every single link in that chain matters so much. Okay, let's pivot slightly to the types of evidence they're actually collecting and putting into that chain. Our sources list four main categories: fruits of the crime, tools of the crime, contraband, and mere evidence. Can you give us quick examples of each?
Sure, these categories help classify the legal status and relevance of items found. Fruits of the crime are the things the criminal gained from committing the crime. The loot, basically. Stolen cash from a robbery, jewelry from a burglary, maybe a car obtained through fraudulent papers.
Okay, the profits.
Right. Tools of the crime are the instruments used to commit the crime. A crowbar used to pry open a door, the gun used in a shooting, lockpicks, a computer used to hack into a system, even a getaway car could be considered a tool.
The means to commit the crime. Got it.
Contraband refers to items that are illegal to possess in themselves, regardless of the specific crime being investigated. Things like illegal drugs, unregistered automatic weapons, counterfeit money, child pornography. Possession itself is a crime.
Okay. Illegal just to have it.
Yes. And finally, mere evidence. This is a broader category for anything else that tends to prove a fact related to the crime, but isn't one of the other three. It could be the victim's blood-stained shirt, a suspect's fingerprint left at the scene, fibers transferred during contact, a threatening letter, surveillance footage. It's evidence because it links someone, proves an element, or tells part of the story.
That clears up the categories nicely. Now for the really detailed part. How do investigators actually preserve these different types of evidence safely and effectively once they find them? The sources list incredibly specific procedures for everything from guns to blood to paint chips.
This is where the meticulousness really ramps up, because improper handling or packaging can destroy the evidentiary value just as easily as a broken chain of custody. The overarching goals are always to prevent breaking, spoiling, loss, or contamination.
Okay, general principle.
Now, a huge one, especially for biological or potentially damp evidence, is use paper, not plastic. Plastic bags trap moisture, which promotes mold and bacterial growth, and that rapidly degrades things like DNA. Paper bags or envelopes allow air circulation, letting the item air dry, which preserves it much better. Containers should generally fit the item snugly to prevent movement and damage. And critically, each item found in a different location or different types of items found in the same location must be packaged separately to prevent cross-contamination. You don't put the suspect's bloody knife in the same bag as the victim's torn shirt.
Makes sense. Separate containers always. What about wet stuff?
Wet evidence, like blood-soaked clothing or muddy shoes, generally must be allowed to air dry completely in a controlled environment before final packaging in paper. Packaging wet items leads to rot and degradation. The exception is liquid blood collected directly, which often needs to be refrigerated or sometimes frozen, depending on the circumstances, to prevent bacterial breakdown.
Okay, dry it first if possible, package separately in paper. Safety precautions.
Always paramount. Disposable latex or nitrile gloves are standard for handling any evidence. Change gloves frequently, especially between handling different items, to prevent cross-contamination. Dispose of used gloves properly. Wash hands thoroughly afterwards. Avoid touching your face or mouth. Be extremely cautious with any bodily fluids due to the risk of bloodborne pathogens. These steps protect the investigator and prevent the investigator from contaminating the evidence with their own DNA or trace materials.
Okay, let's get specific. How do they handle firearms? Safety must be huge there.
Absolutely. Number one priority. Always treat every firearm as if it's loaded. Keep your finger off the trigger and outside the trigger guard until ready to shoot, which they aren't doing here. Keep the muzzle pointed in a safe direction. Know your target and what's beyond it. These are basic firearm safety rules, but critical at a scene.
How do they handle it without messing up evidence?
Carefully. They first note and document the condition as found safety on or off, hammer cocked or down. If it's a semi-automatic, they'll carefully remove the magazine first, then eject any cartridge from the chamber, packaging that live round separately and labeling it. They document the make, model, caliber, serial number. If it's a revolver, they might mark the cylinder position relative to the frame before opening it to know which chamber was under the hammer. If the hammer is cocked, they carefully lower it. They uniquely identify each chamber and remove the contents, cartridges, or casings.
What about securing it?
They secure it to make it safe, often using a zip tie through the action, like the ejection port and magazine well, so it physically cannot fire, but not down the barrel. Critically, they never stick anything down the barrel, like a pencil, as that can damage the microscopic rifling marks needed for ballistics comparison. They also never clean, disassemble, or dry fire the weapon at the scene that can destroy trace evidence or alter mechanical conditions. They document the condition thoroughly and package it, usually in a sturdy cardboard gun box.
Do they check for trace evidence first?
Yes. They should visually inspect it for things like blood, hair, fibers, or soil before packaging. If found that trace evidence needs to be documented and collected separately, carefully, before the gun goes in the box.
Do they mark the gun itself?
Generally, no. You don't want to scratch or alter the firearm. They mark the evidence tag attached to the trigger guard or mark the outer packaging box. The exception might be marking revolver cylinders, as mentioned.
What if it's found underwater?
Special procedure for that. Document the location precisely. Do not try to clean it or dislodge dirt or debris, especially from the barrel. Collect a sample of the same water it was found in. Then carefully lift the firearm and place it fully submerged in a leak-proof container filled with that same water.
Keep it wet. Why?
To prevent rust. If a submerged gun dries out, it can start rusting very quickly, which can obscure or destroy the fine markings needed for forensic analysis. Keeping it in the water it was found in preserves its current state until it gets to the lab.
Fascinating. Okay, what about fired evidence, bullets, casings?
For fired evidence like bullets, cartridge casings, shotgun wads, or pellets, the location of each piece is meticulously documented and photographed first. Each item is collected carefully using gloved hands or rubber-tipped forceps to avoid scratching microscopic markings. Depending on the situation, items might be packaged together, for example, all casings from one area, or separately, always with clear labels.
What if a bullet is stuck in a wall?
If a projectile is embedded, say in wood or plaster, they try to carefully dig it out without touching the sides of the bullet itself, again, to protect those markings. Sometimes this means cutting out a larger section of the material around the bullet and removing it that way. If it's really difficult or risks damaging the bullet significantly, they might recover the entire section of the wall or object it's embedded in and send that whole thing to the lab for careful extraction there. The goal is always preserve the bullet's individual characteristics.
Okay, preserve those markings. What about paint evidence, like from a hit and run?
For paint, if it's on a movable object and can't be easily removed without damaging it, they submit the whole object if practical. If collecting samples, so from a damaged vehicle, they use a clean knife blade or scraper. It's crucial to collect all layers down to the bare metal or plastic because the sequence and composition of layers are unique identifiers. Samples should be taken from several different damaged areas, as paint can vary. Smeared paint might look different too, so that should be noted.
How do they collect tiny chips?
Fragments can be carefully picked up with forceps, gently swept onto clean paper, or even collected using a filtered vacuum attachment designed for evidence collection. Clothing from victims or suspects that might have paint transfer should also be collected, packaged separately in paper. Two big don'ts for paint: no tape lifts, the adhesive interferes with lab analysis, and no plastic bags because static electricity can make the tiny chips cling stubbornly and be hard to remove without damage.
So where do paint chips go?
Into a paper fold, often called a druggist's fold, a small vial, or an evidence tin. Envelopes should have their corners sealed to prevent tiny chips leaking out.
Got it. Paper folds, not tape or plastic. What about hair and fibers?
Hair and fibers are incredibly common, but also incredibly easy to lose. Wind, movement, static electricity, they get displaced easily. So protecting the scene is vital. Maybe closing doors and windows upon arrival and noting which were open. Restricting access is key. Because they're so fragile, collecting hair and fiber evidence is often prioritized early in the scene processing, before heavier activity might disturb them. Collection methods include careful picking with forceps, taping — tape is often used for fibers, unlike paint — or specialized vacuuming. Again, packaged in paper folds or envelopes.
Okay, prioritize the fragile stuff. Now, seize drugs. Lots of variety there.
Huge variety: solids, liquids, plant material, pills, powders. Packaging is critical to prevent loss, contamination, or degradation. Different sources must be packaged separately. Whenever possible, leave the drugs in their original packaging, like baggies or vials they were found in, and place that inside the official evidence packaging.
Why keep the original packaging?
Two reasons. It helps preserve the drugs from exposure, and that original packaging might hold valuable latent fingerprints or DNA evidence from the person who handled it.
Ah, dual purpose. How do they package different forms?
Dry solids, powders, or dry plant material usually go into plastic, zippered bags. Plastic is generally okay for dry drugs. Wet drug evidence, if it can't be dried first, needs a leak-proof container. Fresh plants like marijuana need to be packaged in paper or burlap sacks, something breathable to allow drying and prevent mold. Liquids should go into sealable plastic bottles, avoiding glass because it breaks easily, and don't overfill them. Sharps like needles require puncture-resistant containers for safety.
What about weight? That's usually important for drug charges.
Very important. Investigators need to clearly note whether the recorded weight includes the packaging or not. Sometimes they'll weigh it with packaging and note gross weight, or they might estimate and subtract the packaging weight, clearly stating that. Accuracy in weighing and documentation is crucial for charging and prosecution.
Okay. How about clothing removal from a person, say a victim or suspect?
There's a specific procedure for that too, to capture trace evidence. Ideally, have the person stand on a large, clean sheet of paper while their clothes are being removed. Handle the clothing carefully. If any garments are wet, they need to be air dried completely before packaging. Do not try to remove evidence from the clothing at the scene. Don't shake it out. Don't pick things off. The exact location of trace evidence on the clothing can be important.
So collect the whole garment as is.
Yes. Package each item of clothing separately in its own paper bag. After all clothing is collected, carefully fold up that sheet of paper the person was standing on. Any trace evidence that fell off — hairs, fibers, debris — will be trapped inside. Package that paper sheet as a separate evidence item.
Clever way to catch falling trace. Now, the really sensitive stuff: biological samples. Blood, saliva, semen. Extremely specific rules here, right?
Absolutely. These are highly prone to degradation and contamination, and the protocols are very strict. The recurring theme, as mentioned, is generally air dry whenever possible and package in paper, not plastic, to prevent moisture buildup and bacterial growth that destroys DNA. Refrigeration or freezing might be needed for liquids or specific situations. Controls are also often required.
Controls? What are those?
A control sample is a clean, unstained sample of the collection material, like a clean swab or piece of cloth, treated the same way as the evidence sample, be moistened if the collection swab was moistened. This helps the lab ensure that any results they get are from the evidence itself and not from contamination on the collection materials.
Okay, makes sense. Let's run through the specifics. Liquid blood.
If it's liquid blood on a person or surface, absorb it onto a clean cotton cloth or swab. Collect the control swab too. Let both air dry completely. Package them separately in clean paper envelopes or paper bags, sealing corners. Again, no plastic containers for dried samples.
Dried blood on a person or object.
If it's dried on skin, collect it using a swab lightly moistened with sterile distilled water. Collect a dry control swab and a moistened control swab. Let the evidence swab air dry. Package all three separately in paper, no plastic. If it's on a small, movable object, submit the whole object if possible, packaged in paper to prevent the stain rubbing off. If it's on a large, immovable object, like a wall or floor, scrape the stain off onto clean paper if possible, or absorb it onto a moistened swab, let it air dry, package in paper, with controls. Or if necessary, cut out the stain portion with an unstained control portion nearby, let it air dry, package in paper, never plastic for dried stains. Preservation of bloodstain pattern is also key, so avoid wiping through them during collection if possible.
You mentioned freezing blood found in snow or water earlier. Why freeze that specifically?
Right, that's the exception to air drying. For blood in snow or water, collect it immediately before it gets more diluted. Absorb it onto a cloth swab. Get rid of as much excess snow water as possible. Place the sample in a clean, airtight container. Plastic is okay here because you're freezing it, not drying it, and freeze it as soon as possible. Freezing stops enzymatic degradation and prevents further dilution, which is critical when the sample is already compromised by water.
Okay, freezing for wet diluted blood. What about saliva, like from a bite mark or a drinking glass?
For collecting a reference sample directly from someone, buccal swab. Use clean cotton swabs. Rub the inside of their cheeks and gums thoroughly. Let the swabs air dry completely. Packaging by paper envelopes, no plastic. Identify each sample clearly. These usually don't need refrigeration. For liquid saliva found at a scene, for example, spit. Absorb onto a cloth swab, get a control, let air dry, package in paper. No plastic. For dry saliva stains on objects, submit small objects whole if possible, packaged in paper. On immovable objects, scrape or use a moistened swab, air dry, package in paper, with controls, no plastic. Same principles apply to urine stains.
And semen evidence. Similar process.
Very similar. Liquid semen, absorb onto cloth swab, control, air dry, paper envelope, no plastic. Dry semen stains, submit small objects, whole in paper. On immovable objects, scrape swab with moistened swab or cut out section with control.
Yeah.
Air dry, package in paper, no plastic. The key is always air dry and paper packaging to preserve DNA.
What about sexual assault evidence collection? That seems particularly sensitive and complex.
It is. Victims should undergo a medical examination by trained personnel, often a SANE nurse, sexual assault nurse examiner, using a standardized sexual assault evidence kit, SAEK. These kits contain all the necessary swabs, collection tubes, and paperwork to systematically collect potential biological evidence from vaginal, oral, and anal areas, as well as fingernail scrapings, clothing, etc.
And preserving those kit samples?
These samples, once collected in the kit, generally need to be refrigerated, not usually frozen unless specific lab protocols say otherwise, and submitted to the crime lab as soon as possible to prevent degradation of fragile DNA evidence.
What about drug-facilitated sexual assaults? Is evidence collection different?
Yes, timing is critical there. If drugs like GHB, Rohypnol, roofies, or ecstasy are suspected, urine and blood samples need to be collected very quickly. GHB clears the blood in just 4-7 hours, though it lasts longer in urine, up to 24 hours. Rohypnol might be found in urine for up to 60 hours. Ecstasy, maybe 2 to 5 days. So getting those biological samples within that first 24-hour window is vital. Urine samples specifically need refrigeration within 24 hours to preserve the drug metabolites for testing.
The precision across all these evidence types is just staggering. It really connects back to the bigger picture. Every step ensures the evidence is scientifically sound and legally admissible.
Absolutely. These aren't just arbitrary rules. They're based on scientific principles of preservation and legal requirements for admissibility. Getting the collection and packaging right protects the integrity of the investigation, the rights of the accused, and ultimately the pursuit of justice. One wrong step here can invalidate crucial evidence.
Okay, we've walked through securing the scene, searching, photographing, sketching, and the incredibly detailed evidence collection and chain of custody. What happens as things wind down at the scene itself? This is stage 4, the scene wrap-up, including debriefing and the final survey.
Right, as the intensive on-scene processing concludes, these two steps are crucial for ensuring completeness and transitioning to the next phase. The debriefing comes first. It's usually run by the lead investigator or crime scene supervisor.
Why debrief before the final check?
Because it's a chance for everyone involved on the processing, search teams, photographers, evidence techs, specialists to share their observations, discuss preliminary findings, and raise any issues or insights before everyone packs up. Maybe one team found something that impacts how another team interprets their findings. It's a critical feedback loop.
What gets covered in the debriefing?
All sorts of things. It's an opportunity for follow-up input. Did anyone see something that needs rechecking? Are there special requests for lab analysis? They confirm post-scene responsibilities. Who's notifying next of kin? Who's handling media inquiries? Who's physically transporting the evidence to the lab or storage? They might reassess the need for specialists who weren't initially called, then the SAM. Maybe the findings suggest an entomologist or anthropologist is needed after all. They coordinate with the pathologist about autopsy timing. If multiple agencies are involved, they share key data.
Sounds like a comprehensive review.
It is. It helps consolidate what evidence was collected, plan the sequence of forensic testing and gavel fingerprints before DNA swabbing on an item, ensure the search is truly complete, and prepare for any necessary press releases while reminding everyone about case confidentiality. You asked earlier about confidentiality. Why is it so important?
Yeah, why the secrecy?
It protects the investigation's integrity. Leaking details could tip off suspects who are still at large, allowing them to destroy evidence or flee. It could contaminate potential witness testimony if people hear details through the media before being formally interviewed. It can compromise ongoing surveillance or future investigative strategies. Maintaining confidentiality protects the evidence, the witnesses, and the ability to bring the case to a just conclusion.
Okay, makes sense. Confidentiality is strategic. So after the debriefing clarifies everything, then comes the final survey.
Yes, the final survey is exactly what it sounds like. A final, meticulous walkthrough of the entire crime scene after the debriefing and before the scene is officially released.
What's its purpose? Another check?
It's the ultimate double check. Its primary goal is to ensure absolutely all evidence has been collected, the scene has been thoroughly processed according to the plan, and nothing is being left behind inadvertently. That includes ensuring no pieces of equipment, cameras, tools, notebooks, even trash generated by the team are left at the scene.
Wouldn't want to leave your flashlight behind.
Exactly. Or worse, leave behind something that could be misinterpreted later. They also confirm that any dangerous conditions identified during the investigation, like structural damage or hazardous materials, have been properly reported and addressed or secured. If the investigation itself caused any damage, like forcing a door, that damage should be documented and photographed during this final survey for accountability. Only after this thorough visual inspection confirms everything is accounted for and safe is the scene officially released, usually back to the property owner or responsible party following department policy. It's closing the book on the physical scene itself.
An exhaustive final check. But as you said, the investigation is far from over. The scene might be released, but then comes the continuing or follow-up investigation. What does that phase involve? It sounds like where a lot of the less visible work happens.
You're absolutely right. The preliminary on-scene investigation is often just the tip of the iceberg. The continuing or follow-up investigation is where detectives dig deeper, connect the dots, and build the case over potentially long periods.
What are the key elements?
It involves systematically following up on leads generated during the preliminary phase, initiating new lines of inquiry based on analysis of the initial evidence and reports, constantly developing and revising the scheme or theory of the crime as new information comes in, who did what, when, why, how, analyzing the legal significance of everything found, how does this piece of evidence fit? Does this strengthen the case or point in a new direction?
And witness work continues too.
Oh, definitely. A huge part is the ongoing search for new witnesses who maybe weren't identified initially. Liaising with the original witnesses, maybe re-interviewing them if new questions arise or their initial statements need clarification after reviewing evidence. And crucially, preparing and conducting witness identification procedures like lineups.
Lineups. How do those work fairly? You mentioned two types.
Right. There's the simultaneous lineup where the witness sees all the fillers and the suspect if included at the same time. And the sequential lineup where the witness views individuals one at a time and makes a decision on each before seeing the next. Many jurisdictions now prefer sequential. As research suggests, it reduces the risk of relative judgment, where the witness picks the person who looks most like the perpetrator compared to the others, rather than based on absolute recognition.
That makes sense. What instructions do they give the witness? That seems critical for fairness.
Extremely critical. The instructions are designed to prevent suggestion and reduce pressure on the witness. They must tell the witness things like, It's just as important to clear innocent people as it is to identify the guilty. The person who committed the crime may or may not be in this lineup. The individuals might look different now than they did at the time of the incident, different hair, clothes, etc. And importantly, the police will continue investigating regardless of whether you make an identification or not.
Takes the pressure off. Makes it okay to say, I don't know, or he's not here.
Precisely. These standardized, non-suggestive instructions are vital for ensuring the reliability and admissibility of any identification made. It's about accuracy, not just getting a pick.
Very careful procedures. What are the other elements of this ongoing follow-up phase?
It continues with establishing a strong liaison with the crime laboratory technicians. Investigators need to understand the lab results, discuss their significance, maybe request further tests based on findings. The lab reports often drive the next investigative steps.
Like a DNA hit pointing to a new suspect.
Exactly. Or ballistics matching a gun found on a suspect to casings at the scene. The follow-up also involves formally identifying all perpetrators and any accomplices, locating and legally arresting them if not already done, preparing wanted notices if they fled. It might involve conducting surveillance, legally, or further interrogation of suspects. And finally, a huge part is meticulously preparing the entire case package and conferring regularly with the prosecutor, ensuring they have everything needed to file charges and proceed towards trial.
It really is that seamless transition, isn't it? From the physical evidence at the scene, to the lab analysis, to the human intelligence from interviews and surveillance, all feeding into the legal strategy.
It's a constant cycle. Lab reports, guide interviews, interview statements might lead to new searches with warrants, surveillance might confirm alibis or connections. It all builds on itself, ideally towards that proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, so after all this incredible, painstaking work, from the first call to the final lab report, the investigation culminates in case management. Why is this final organizational step so critical? You said earlier, it'd be a shame for it all to fall apart due to bad paperwork.
It would be a tragedy, honestly. Case management is the final, crucial step that ensures all that effort translates into a usable, understandable, and effective legal case. Its purpose is to create an organized, easily understood, factual, and thorough account of the entire investigation.
Why is that so important, beyond just being neat?
Several reasons. It helps the investigators themselves, and especially the prosecutors, identify any serious weaknesses in the case before it gets to court, allowing time to potentially address them. It provides assurance that if a case fails to be prosecuted, it's not because the officers made mistakes in preparation or documentation. It ensures accountability and professionalism. Imagine months of work going down the drain because a key report was lost or witness statements weren't properly filed. Proper case management prevents that.
So it's the quality control check and the final packaging for the legal system. What's the practical value of a well-prepared case folder? What actually goes into it?
The value is immense. Practically, it prevents duplication of work because all the information is centralized and organized. It demonstrates the efficiency of the officers in the department. It's incredibly useful for review by the prosecutor who needs to quickly grasp the case and for the grand jury if seeking an indictment. And there's a strategic value, too. A meticulously prepared, professional-looking case file gives the defense attorney the impression that the investigation was thorough and competent. This can actually encourage plea agreements because the defense sees the strength of the case laid out clearly and realizes a trial might be futile.
Interesting psychological aspect, too. So what's typically in that folder?
The main case folder contains all the core documents generated throughout the investigation. That includes the initial offense report, all supplemental reports detailing follow-up actions, copies of all witness and victim statements, any voluntary confessions, fingerprint cards and comparison reports from the lab, ballistics reports, DNA analysis reports, photos, sketches, log sheets, basically everything pertinent. Often, there's also a prosecution summary document prepared specifically for the prosecutor. This distills the key case facts, explicitly addresses the legality of the arrest and any searches or seizures, anticipating challenges, lists all the witnesses, and summarizes the expected nature of their testimony.
It sounds like the complete story, meticulously documented.
It has to be. If you connect it back to the very beginning, that final case file isn't just a collection of papers. It's the culmination of every single precise step we've discussed, from securing the scene legally to the specific search pattern chosen, the careful photography, the measured sketch, the painstaking evidence collection with its unbroken chain of custody, the follow-up interviews, the lab results. It's the entire narrative, documented for justice. It has to be thorough, accurate, and organized to be effective.
What an incredible, detailed journey we've taken today. From defining a crime and that critical first response, through the methodical, almost scientific processing of a scene, the searching, the photos, the sketches, the mind-boggling detail in evidence collection and chain of custody, all the way through the ongoing follow-up and that final, crucial case management. It's just crystal clear how much intense rigor, dedication, and sheer meticulousness goes into every single investigation.
It really is. The systematic nature, the unwavering commitment to scientific principles where applicable, and that absolute need for legal precision at every turn. It's a testament to the professionalism required. It's this complex interplay of science, law, critical thinking, and just plain hard work, all aimed at discovering the truth and achieving a just outcome.
So maybe the next time you hear about a criminal investigation, whether it's on the news or even in a fictional show, you can think about this unseen, incredibly meticulous process we've unpacked today. Every detail matters. Every measurement, every photo angle, every link in that chain of custody, it's all purposefully building towards that ultimate goal of finding the truth. It is so much more than what usually meets the eye.
And maybe consider this thought as we wrap up. In our world, which relies more and more on technology-advanced DNA, digital forensics, AI analyzing patterns, how will these fundamental principles of investigation we've discussed adapt, or will they remain constant? The core search for truth, the need for legal justification, the meticulous documentation, those probably stay. But the tools, the types of evidence, and the methods criminals use are constantly evolving. How does law enforcement keep pace while upholding those critical standards? It's an ongoing challenge.
That's a really fascinating question to ponder. How do the fundamentals hold up against technological change? Thank you for joining us on this truly deep dive today.